From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I have thought about death quite a lot. I think that the way to deal with that is to have a good, hard think about it until you've got your head straight about it, and then think, oh, well, that's what I think about it, so I won't think about it anymore now.
Today, we will have a good, hard think about death and hear from a mountain climber who died on Mount Everest and lived to tell the tale.
There was no pulse, there was no breathing. One of them poked me in the eye, there was no response, so...
So you were dead?
Well, yeah. That's what they concluded, and the expedition leader, 2 hours after I was just lying there, ordered them to come down.
Also, a man who's scoured the history of philosophy to find the collected wisdom about how to think about death.
We should not flee death through escape and fear and the rest, but we should face up to it and make the certainty of our mortality structure the life that we live freely now.
But what if we don't have to die? Would you want to live forever? It may sound like a crackpot question even to ask, but biomedical gerontologist Aubrey de Grey says there's no scientific reason why we can't conquer all the natural causes of death. So he's spearheading a campaign to do just that as chairman and chief science officer of the Methuselah Foundation, based in Cambridge, England. Now, I should say that de Grey is not your conventional scientist. He's a maverick. You see it right away. He even has a beard that hangs down nearly to his waist. And as Steve Paulson discovered, Aubrey de Grey is the rare scientist who ranges freely across all the research areas that study aging and dying.
How long do you think human beings could potentially live?
I don't think there is any inherent limit on how long humans can live with adequately comprehensive medicine. I think that we have plenty of precedent from simple man-made machines like cars or houses or aeroplanes or whatever. We know that if we can do sufficiently comprehensive maintenance on them, then they just don't get any less functional as they get older. We can keep them going indefinitely. And the human body is, after all, just a machine. It'll take us a while before we have sufficiently comprehensive technology, but one day we'll get there, and at that point, human lifespan will no longer be controlled by the natural rate of decay that happens in the absence of medicine.
When you say indefinitely, you're talking 500 years, 1,000 years, even longer?
Indefinitely means indefinitely. It will be determined by the rate at which we die from things that have nothing to do with how old we are, things like being hit by trucks and so on.
And how far into the future do you see this very long lifespan happening?
I think that we are getting pretty close. I think we're in striking distance of developing the sufficiently comprehensive biotechnology to give us this. I think we have maybe a 50-50 chance of getting there within the next 30 years.
Within the next 30 years of living to be 500 or 1,000 years old?
Of course, people will not be living to 1,000 years until 900 years from now or thereabouts. But in terms of the actual rate of decline, yes. The correct way to think about this is that simply we will be postponing, comprehensively, the age-related decline and disease and debilitation and dependence that we see. And there will be this side effect that, therefore, people will not die of aging. They will only die of other stuff.
Hmm. And when you're talking about people living to be very old, I mean, you're not talking about people sort of doddering around when they're 300 pushing a walker. I mean, you're talking about a 300-year-old being the equivalent of a 40-year-old today.
You got it. There is absolutely no prospect whatsoever of extending frail life. Frail people are in a bad way. Being frail is risky. You will die fairly soon if you're frail. Therefore, the way to extend healthy life, to postpone the debilitation of aging, is to keep people youthful.
Okay. So from a scientific perspective, how do you go about delaying or even stopping aging?
Ultimately, it's a repair and maintenance job. And that's really good news. That's the first piece of really good news, because it means that it will be applicable to people who are already in middle age before we start, people who have accumulated a substantial but still manageable amount of molecular and cellular damage. So what we have to do is essentially repair those various types of molecular and cellular damage that accumulate throughout our lives as a side effect of our normal metabolic processes. That means, for example, there are various tissues in which cells die and are not naturally replaced by the division of other cells. So we use, for example, stem cell therapy to replace those cells biomedically. Another aspect of aging is the accumulation of indigestible molecules of various sorts, things that the cell makes sometimes by accident as a side effect of normal metabolic processes, but that then the cell does not know how to get rid of, does not know how to destroy or excrete or whatever, and those things accumulate and eventually they cause problems like cardiovascular disease or neurodegeneration or macular degeneration in the elderly. We need to figure out how to get rid of that stuff. mutations accumulate and they cause cancer. We need to figure out how to cope with that problem. And there are a relatively small number of such categories.
So basically what you're saying is isolate all the different areas where people die from, quote, natural causes. And if you can pinpoint all of those, conceivably, from an engineering perspective, you can stop them all.
That's exactly right. And the critical thing is to intervene at the right point in the chain of events. We will never succeed in, as I mentioned a moment ago, keeping people alive in a frail state, which is what a geriatrician tries to do, and of course it's a very much a losing battle. If you intervene a bit earlier in the chain of events, and you intervene in these originating phenomena, the things that accumulate and eventually cause disease, then you don't have this problem of the downward spiral of things getting harder and harder.
So at what age are you talking about? When do you start intervening?
I think that's going to change with time as the therapies get more and more sophisticated. But initially, I think the ideal age to intervene will be maybe 55, 60, 65 sort of time.
Really? I mean, you would wait that long?
Sure. Ultimately, in the same way that you don't take a car into the garage 1 month after you bought a brand new car, it doesn't have enough damage to need any repair. You wait until it's got a certain amount of damage, and then you take it in. So similarly, a middle-aged person is not dead yet, and they're still doing okay, but there's enough gone wrong with them at the molecular and cellular level that there's a respectable amount of restoration to be done to make them biologically young adults again.
So is that to say that once you start doing these body repairs, whatever you want to call them, that people will kind of forever look like they're 55 or 60 years old?
Absolutely. Certainly, if you're making people biologically youthful on the inside, you'll certainly be able to make them biologically youthful on the outside as well.
But are you actually talking about reversing the aging process?
Absolutely.
So people would actually start to look younger then?
Absolutely. If you take a middle-aged person, we're not going to keep them in middle age, either internally or externally. We bona fide rejuvenation, restoring people to a biologically younger state.
Now, you have talked about some of these different processes that you would do, and in your writing you've identified seven big categories of aging.
That's right.
You're saying that each one of those, theoretically, scientists could stop. Has anyone come close to stopping any one of these processes?
Oh, absolutely. This is not theory, really. This is, engineering design, if you like. This is technology. And some of these things are further away than others, certainly. Otherwise, we wouldn't be as long as 30 years away from getting the whole thing to work. But some of the things we need to do are already in clinical trials, absolutely. So, for example, stem cell therapies are, of course, hot news, not just in the lab, but also some stem cell therapies are being applied clinically already. I mentioned the elimination of indigestible molecules. So one type of indigestible molecule that really matters is stuff called amyloid that accumulates not inside cells but in the spaces between cells. And there's clinical trials going on to get rid of the amyloid that accumulates in the brain in Alzheimer's disease, and people are very hopeful that that will have a major effect. Some things are not working in humans yet, but they're working in mice reasonably well. Things like getting rid of cells that are accumulating, not necessarily because they're proliferating uncontrollably, but because they're not dying when they should. That's a somewhat different problem. Some things are really still at the stage of cell culture, of individual cells in a dish, rather than whole animals, even mice. And those are things that maybe won't get to whole animals for another maybe 10 years if we're unlucky, and then another maybe 10 or 20 years after that before they are clinically available.
But what about something like cancer, which is one of the items on your list? I mean, scientists have been trying for decades to stop cancer, and when people talk about the war on cancer, how close are we to ending cancer?
That's a very good question. And for sure, the reason why cancer is on my list is because it is correct to regard cancer as part of aging. In fact, it's correct to regard cancer as the hardest part of aging to fix, because unlike everything else, cancer has natural selection at its disposal. Every cell in the cancer is this, furnace of inventiveness, so to speak. Yeah, what do? The approach that I've proposed to addressing cancer is extremely ambitious and extremely elaborate, and that's precisely because the war on cancer has been such a failure. Now, when I say a failure, of course, the war on cancer, it's a good thing that it happened. We have made more progress than we would have done if the budget of the NCI had not been trebled in 71 or whatever it was. But obviously things have been much, much slower than was predicted back then. The reason things have been slower is because cancer is so hard to fix, and that's because evolution is so ingenious.
Can you briefly outline that?
Sure. So what makes cancer a problem is, of course, it's unlimited cell division. And one thing we know for sure and certain about cell division is that every time a cell divides, the chromosome ends, the telomeres get shorter. So the reason that cancers are able to get big enough to kill us is because they turn on a system, one of two systems, to combat that problem, to elongate the ends of the chromosomes. I want not simply to inhibit that system, which a number of other people are looking at, I want to delete the genes that are necessary for those systems to work.
Why do you want to live so long?
I don't actually. You're asking the wrong question there, because I don't actually have any particular fixation about living a long time. I don't even know whether I want to live to 100. The thing is, though, I do know that I want to make that choice when I'm 99. I don't want to have that choice gradually removed from me by my declining health.
You must want to live a long time. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, you are a man on a mission here. You've devoted your whole life, in a way, to trying to extend longevity. I can't imagine that you wouldn't want to live to be very old yourself.
Well, you really are wrong. I am driven predominantly by humanitarian goals. I don't like to see people getting frail and decrepit and dependent and miserable and dead. I like to give people the chance. I want to save lives. I want to alleviate suffering and save lives.
But why? I mean, why not take the opposite reaction and say, well, death is a natural part of life. That's just part of what it means to be human.
I'm not eliminating death with this. It's just trying to eliminate one particularly nasty cause of death. People are still going to get hit by trucks, and I'm not working to stop that from happening.
You actually see this as an ethical imperative to extend lifespan.
I would go so far as to say it's more than just an ethical imperative. It's a psychological imperative as well. This is how we are. What would be unnatural would be to say, oh dear, you know, we should ignore our ability and our desire to actually, you know, keep healthy and save lives and so on, because it's different from all the things we've done before. What's natural for the human being is to explore their ability to change their world for the better.
That's Aubrey de Grey, Chief Science Officer of the Methuselah Foundation. If you'd like to hear what Aubrey de Grey thinks about the ethical and environmental implications of extended lifespans and how specifically we could reverse the aging process, you'll find Steve Paulson's complete, unedited interview on our website at ttbook.org. So, would you like to live forever? The Italian philosopher and novelist Umberto Eco has been pondering the question, and he thinks immortality would be a nightmare.
Either immortality is for everybody, and we shall have an unbearable world full of too many people, and what would mean to listen for 2,000 years the Goldberg variation of Bach? Today, they look to me so beautiful, but after 3,000 years, they would be horrible. And the other disadvantage is that if I am the only one to be immortal, so I will make a terrible life, having lost all the people I loved, living among young people that wouldn't understand me and I will not understand them. And so they are the advantages of death.
That's philosopher Umberto Eco. The English writer Julian Barnes has also been mulling over the whole business of what remains after we die. Here's an excerpt from his memoir on mortality, Nothing to be Frightened of. We live, we die, we are remembered, we are forgotten. Not immediately, but in trenches. We remember our parents through most of their adult lives, our grandparents through their last third. Beyond that, perhaps, lies a great-grandfather with a scratchy beard and a rank odor. Perhaps he smelt of fish. And beyond that, photographs and a little haphazard documentation. In the future, there will be a technological update of my shallow drawer. Generations of ancestors will survive on film and tape and disc, moving, talking, smiling, proving that they, too, were here. As an adolescent, I once hid a tape recorder under the table during dinner in an attempt to prove that, far from it being the social event my mother decreed every meal should be, no one ever said anything remotely interesting. And I should therefore be excused conversation and allowed to read a book if I preferred. I did not explain these personal aims, thinking they would become self-evident once the clatter of cutlery, banalities, and non sequiturs was played back. Annoyingly, my mother was enchanted by the tape, declaring that we all sounded just like a Pinter play, to my mind a mixed compliment in both directions. And then we continued exactly as before. And I never kept the tapes, so that my parents' voices are quite extinct in the world, and play now only in my head. That's an excerpt from Julian Barnes' book, Nothing to be Frightened Of. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Diana Antill has been the editor of some of the most celebrated writers of our time, including V.S. Naipaul, John Updike, Simone de Beauvoir, and Philip Roth. During her mid-80s, she got the writing bug herself, so she wrote a memoir. And then at the age of 91, another memoir, called Somewhere Towards the End. And Strange Champs recently sat down with Diana Antill to talk about how life changes in old age.
One of the phrases that comes up a lot in your writing about aging is falling away, as though getting older involves a kind of sloughing off. Of what?
Well, sloughing off of a lot of things. I mean, one is no longer a sexual being, and that is a very big change for most people. I know as far as my own life was concerned, that was an important and interesting and fascinating part of it for a very long time. And that goes. And if you're unlucky like me and get deaf, music goes. That I regret. That I do very much regret. Drinking goes. I was never a heavy drinker, but I liked my wine. I enjoyed drinking. And now I can't drink at all. It disagrees with me. And so that's, you know, pleasures of various kinds disappear. But if you actually find yourself no longer wanting them, it isn't so bad not having them. I mean, I would like to have music still. That I do very much regret. But sex, I don't mind having lost at all. And I find that it's very interesting to be able to have really friendly and loving relationships with men which are uncomplicated by sex.
Yeah, you wrote at some point, I think, that sex, to a certain extent, obliterates the individuality of younger women. Does that mean that after you decided your sex life was over, that you felt yourself becoming clearer to yourself?
Yes, I did. I did. And other interests were able to become much more important. I think young women, even when they try not to, tend to value themselves according to the effect they have on men. It's very difficult not to do that. And when that doesn't matter any longer, it's a great release, really.
Kind of freedom.
Yes, it is. It's a kind of freedom, and you start using your mind on other things more.
You wrote a lovely chapter about your last lover, a man named Sam. What was he like?
He was a nice, kind, pleasant man. He was not a demanding man. It wasn't at all a romantic affair. I had had three most important love affairs in my life when I was young. Had ended badly. I'd had a bad time. So that romance had become for me dangerous. I didn't like romantic love anymore. My big relationship from 43 until very recently, was a lovely relationship of which I was extremely fond. And there was plenty of sex in it to begin with, but it was never very romantic. When it had stopped being sexual, and I thought, oh, well, my sex life is over, and Sam turned up and turned out that my sex life wasn't over, but there was no great romantic involvement.
If it wasn't a romantic involvement, what was it?
It was a sexual involvement. We liked each other well enough. I was always interested in him because he had a completely different background to me, and that was interesting. But otherwise, it was just a friendly sexual involvement.
So you would get together mostly to share a meal and to have sex?
We'd have a nice little dinner together and pop into bed.
So was that hard to give up? And at what point did you realize that, that you didn't
simply
want
gave
to
it,
do
it
that?
It gave itself up quietly and gently. We met less and less often, and he was also by no means young. He was older than me a little bit. I think we both of us just began to stop being sexual in a way. And so it just tapered off in quite a friendly, pleasant way.
You said that after sex fell away, it opened up room for other interests, for new things to come into your life. What new interests arrived?
Well, it was also that work had stopped. For instance, I started going to life classes. I've always been interested in drawing and painting. And that was fascinating. I loved doing that. And I became extremely keen gardener, which I still would be if I was physically able to do it, but I can't. But I still do. I'm responsible for a garden, and I take a great interest in it. And I started designing embroideries and making them. And, of course, I've always, always, always read. I'm constantly reading.
Did you find that what you were interested in reading or the way you read changes as you aged?
Yes. I'm much less enthusiastic about novels than I used to be. When I was a publisher, what I was chiefly dealing with was fiction. But now a novel has to be very good in order to hold me. But I'm still extremely interested in learning about things. So that, you know, an interesting book about a person or about a place will hold me, and I love it.
You know, it's interesting. Listening to you talk, a picture is emerging of a woman who has become more and more curious and more open-minded as she's gotten older and older, which is interesting because the usual portrait we're given of older people is that they become much more insular.
I think a lot of people do, you know. But I think that my life that I'd led, being a publisher and meeting writers all my working life, meeting very interesting people, I think it sort of kept my mind going. Now, of course, I long to do all kinds of things that I can't do. I'd love to travel more, which I couldn't do because although I'm quite sharp in my mind still, my legs are very wobbly. I can't walk at all far.
Do you think much about dying?
I have thought about death quite a lot. I think that the way to deal with that is to have a good, hard think about it until you've got your head straight about it and then think, oh, well, that's what I think about it, so I won't think about it anymore now. I'm not frightened of the actual thought of being dead at all. But, of course, what does alarm me, and I think it does everybody, is the possibility of one's body getting more and more infirm and having a horrible time coming up to dying, you know, taking a long time to die. That can happen. And if it does, it'll be very disagreeable. And therefore, I choose not to think about it too much.
Are there any lessons that you have thought of or might pass on to people who are a bit younger than you and looking at the place you've gotten to and are wishing they could arrive at a similar place?
See, I don't know that one person can teach another person anything because we're so different. What I would say is go on doing as much as you possibly can. Make yourself get up in the morning. If you wake up in the morning and you're being lazy and sort of feeble, say to yourself, oh, no, come on, out of bed, up you get, and then you do feel better. Make yourself do things. It's very interesting that if you're actually involved in doing something, it does make your aches and pains go out of your mind. I have quite a lot of aches and pains, and I'm sometimes quite conscious of them. But if I'm doing something interesting, lo and behold, they disappear.
I'd like to end by asking you to read a little bit from your book, and there's one particular passage at the very end when you talk a bit about, well, death, about what dies.
I'd be happy to read it, yes. What dies is not life's value, but the worn-out or damaged container of the self, together with the self's awareness of itself, a way that goes into nothingness with everyone else's. That's what's so disconcerting to an onlooker, because unless someone slips away while unconscious, a person who is just about to die is still fully alive and fully her or himself. I remember thinking, as I sat beside my mother, but she can't be dying because she's still so entirely here. The wonderful words, which turned out to be her last, it was absolutely divine, were not intended as such, but were just part of something she was telling me. The difference between being and non-being is both so abrupt and so vast that it remains shocking even though it happens to every living thing that is, was, or ever will be. What Henry James was thinking of when he called death distinguished, when it is the most commonest thing in life, I can't imagine, though the poor old man was at his last gasp when he said it, so one ought not to carp. No doubt one likes the idea of last words because they soften the shock. Given the physical nature of the act of dying, one has to suppose that most of the pithy ones are apocryphal. But still, one likes to imagine oneself signing off in a memorable way. And a reason why I've sometimes been sorry that I don't believe in God is that I shan't, in fairness, be able to quote, Dieu me pardonnerait, c'est son métier. God will forgive me. It's his job. Words which have always made me laugh, and which, besides, are wonderfully sensible. As it is, what I would like to say is, it's all right. Don't mind not knowing. And foolish though it may be, I have to confess that I still hope the occasion on which I have to say it doesn't come very soon.
That was Diana Athill reading from her memoir Somewhere Towards the End. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Coming up, the Book of Dead Philosophers, and a man who died on Mount Everest and later came back to life. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Simon Critchley gets impatient with many of his fellow philosophers. He doesn't care much about the technical questions of philosophy, but instead is far more interested in the bigger questions about life's meaning. So maybe it's not surprising he wrote The Book of Dead Philosophers, a sweeping and often quirky account of how various philosophers thought about death and died themselves.
The justification for the theme, you know, is the idea that to philosophize is to learn how to die. And
to quote Cicero, right?
To quote Cicero, and this quotation sort of echoes down the ages. But philosophy begins with the death of Socrates, the trial and execution of Socrates. And one of the things that Socrates says, which is crucial to the definition of philosophy, is that the philosopher is the person who is ready to die, who professes death.
Let's talk about Socrates for a moment.
Yeah.
Perhaps the first great philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
Famous, of course, for drinking hemlock after he was condemned to die. Why did the authorities want him dead?
Well, it was a number of charges. And the main charge was corrupting the youth of the city of Athens. And a related charge was impiety towards the gods. Two things which have haunted philosophy down the ages: the accusation of heresy. I mean, many philosophers were condemned as heretics or indeed burnt as heretics in the case of, say, Giordano Bruno, is burnt at the stake in the 16th century. And corrupting the youth in the sense in which Socrates was a charismatic teacher who asked difficult questions of the authorities. So Socrates is the first example of a philosopher who is condemned as a heretic and is tried as a political dissident, as it were, effectively.
So once he was condemned to death, do we know how he actually approached his own death?
It's interesting. I mean, for example, we know nothing about Plato, who was, Socrates' amanuensis, and we know Socrates mainly through the dialogues of Plato. We know nothing about Plato. And after he was condemned, I mean, because he was a citizen of Athens and a respected citizen, he'd been head of the Senate, he was allowed to take his own life. He develops all these stories about the immortality of the soul in this last dialogue, and a big debate amongst classical scholars is whether he believes this or not. Mm. He's surrounded by young male disciples who are very upset that he's dying. He's not upset himself, and he wants to die in his own way, in his own time. And indeed, he dies a little bit ahead of time. He hurries to take the hemlock, and his last words, "Crito, we must honour a cock to Asclepius," this strange remark he makes, which indicates that he thought death was a kind of curative slumber. It was a sacrifice to the god. Anyway, so there's lots of ambiguity in how to understand Socrates' death, particularly around the question of the immortality of the soul.
But it sounds like, from what you've said, that he did believe in an afterlife.
He says in the Apology, which is one of the slightly earlier dialogues, that, well, we have two options. Option one is that death is the end, and that's going to be a long, dreamless sleep. And what could be nicer than that, he says. The second option is that there will be an afterlife, and we'll go down to Hades and see our old friends and be able to perhaps hang out in the company of Homer, Hesiod, and the Greek heroes, and that would be terrific. The afterlife wasn't heaven for the Greeks. The afterlife was a dark place. It was somewhere you would rather not go. There was no sunlight. Yeah.
But it would seem that, not just talking about the ancient Greeks, but philosophers over the ages, that the great divide about how you think about death is whether you believe in an afterlife or not. I mean, presumably most philosophers, maybe the ancient Greeks aside, would find some comfort in the idea of the afterlife, that death would not be so terrifying. I guess I'm wondering if you found that to be the case.
There are philosophers who believed in the afterlife, but in many ways, if you look at the last 3,000 years of the history of philosophy in the round, I mean, there are probably more skeptics than believers. And also, this is the key thing. Is some problem resolved by the idea of me living forever? I don't think so. We still have to face up to the fact of our mortality. And for me, the key thing about, if you look at this question of to philosophize is to learn how to die, and philosophy is what allows us to face up to our mortality, then we should not flee death through escape and fear and the rest, but we should face up to it and make the certainty of our mortality structure the life that we live freely now. So to philosophize is to learn how to die, and learning how to die is learning how to live.
Now, I have to say, one of the pleasures of reading your book is to read about some rather bizarre deaths. There's a certain voyeuristic quality in all of this.
Absolutely.
Tell me about some of the stranger deaths you came across as you were surveying the landscape of philosophers.
Were there any that particularly stuck out in your mind?
Going back throughout the ages, Heraclitus, who apparently suffocated in cow dung.
Suffocated in cow dung. Different stories. On one story, the cow dung was wet and he sort of drowned. Another story, the cow dung was dry and he baked in the sun. But cow dung seems to have got him both ways. He asked to be wrapped in cow dung because he contracted dropsy, whatever dropsy is, while he was out in the hills roaming around. And he was out in the hills roaming around because the people of Ephesus on the present Turkish coast refused to listen to his philosophy. They refused to take him seriously. So he turned his back on them and went out into the hills. And as a consequence, he contracted dropsy and tried to cure himself and died as a consequence. So there are some truly bizarre deaths. And one of the pleasures, when I began the book, I had no idea of what I would find. I mean, how much weirdness there was in the last 3,000 years. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and then there's, I don't know if I'm saying his name right, Diogenes.
Diogenes,
who,
absolutely.
I guess there's speculation on how he died, either by holding his breath or by eating raw octopus.
Yes, yes. He ate raw octopus because Diogenes is a fascinating, fascinating figure. He once described as a Socrates gone mad. And he didn't cook his food because he thought that was too luxurious. Right? He preferred to eat it raw. On one story, he died of the consequences of eating raw octopus. Another story, he died as a consequence of holding his breath. And that happens to a number of philosophers in antiquity. The technique of dying by holding one's breath, it seems incredible to us, but...
Did they actually intentionally did this, or...?
Yeah, I mean, it seems... Well, at least that's the way it's reported. Whether it actually happened, I don't know. But, another little entry in the book is on Zen and the art of dying, and I talk about Japanese Zen Buddhist monks who also had this technique of controlling their death through controlling the moment of their breath, and they would die, as it were, in meditation after having recounted a brief death poem. But to go back to Diogenes, I mean, in fact, funnily enough, last week in New York State government buildings in Albany, someone dressed as Diogenes appeared holding a lamp. He used to walk around with a lamp, Diogenes, trying to find an honest man. And this someone, a guy called Randy Credico, turned up at the Albany State Senate hearings trying to find an honest man in politics and decided there were no honest men in politics and left disgusted. That's where the idea of cynicism comes from.
Now, to skip ahead a number of centuries, mm-hmm. We get to Francis Bacon, who apparently yes. died while somehow trying to study the effects of refrigeration.
Yes, I mean, it's a fantastic story. It's recounted in one of the best books that I know, which is Aubrey's Brief Lives. It's a story whose origin is the great philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who tells it to Aubrey. Bacon was an experimenter, one of the early scientists, and he was driving in his carriage around London. It was snow was on the ground. And he was suddenly struck with the idea that perhaps snow could be used to refrigerate flesh. And so he jumped out of his carriage, accosted a local woman in an inn, and requested a chicken. And the chicken was brought out somehow and slaughtered. And then Bacon proceeded to stuff the chicken full of snow to test as to whether chicken flesh and thereby other forms of animal flesh would refrigerate, which, of course, is a prophetic idea, you know, the origins of refrigeration. But as a consequence, he caught a cold and then withdrew to a local aristocrat's house in, I think it was in Chelsea or something like that. It was quite away from home. And the bed was damp. He contracted pneumonia and died as a consequence. And this is what I call death by empiricism.
But at least he didn't die because the refrigeration didn't work. I mean, because of food poisoning. I mean, he died through very noble means, I guess you could say.
That's right. I mean, unlike Diogenes, who got the food poisoning, right. Bacon not only died without food poisoning, he also developed the technique of refrigeration, which is something we should be grateful for.
We've been talking about some rather freakish deaths, and you also write about some horrible ones. I'm thinking about yes. the Stoic Seneca, who is, in a sense, one of the great philosophers about death, who said at one point, he will live badly who does not know how to die well. But
yes.
Tell us how he died.
Again, he was the most powerful administrator in the Roman Empire at the moment of its greatest power. Unfortunately, his employer was Nero, and Nero was, you know, an irascible character, as legend tells. And Nero became suspicious of Seneca and ordered that he kill himself. And this was an honorable way to exit life. His wife decides to commit suicide with him, Paulina, I think her name is, and they try to commit suicide together, slit their wrists. But he's so old and frail by this time that it doesn't work. And then another order comes from Nero forbidding Paulina's suicide. So she's dragged out. They both slit their wrists. Their wrists are bandaged up, and she's taken off into another room. She lives for another couple of years. Seneca then, after not having died slitting his wrists, decides to take hemlock like the great Socrates. That doesn't work. And during this period, this is a period of several hours. Another thing that you find in many of these stories is that these deaths lasted a long time. And the death scene was something where people were gathered. Seneca wasn't alone. He was surrounded by friends and servants and the rest. And he was dictating letters, ordering his affairs. Anyway, it went on. And eventually they ran a warm bath for him, and he was suffocated in the warm bath and eventually died.
Suffocating actually in the water or by the steam?
Yeah, suffocating with a hot steam, apparently. That's the version given to us by Tacitus, and it's a strangely botched suicide.
Simon Critchley, a philosopher at the New School for Social Research. He talked with Steve Paulson about the Book of Dead Philosophers.
Emmanuel Kant was a real piss and was very rarely stable. Odd Digger was a boozy beggar who could think you under the table. David Hume could out-consume Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And Wittgenstein was a beery swine who was just as sloshed as Schlegel. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. John Stuart Mill, of his own free will, on half a pint of shandy was particularly ill. Plato, they say, could sing it away. Half a grain of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a bugger for the bottle. Hobbes was fond of his dram. And René Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am. Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thing about a bugger when he's pissed.
Monty Python with the Philosopher's Song. There wasn't anything funny about what happened to Lincoln Hall on Mount Everest. At the age of 50, 22 years after he was part of Australia's first attempt to climb Everest, he died just after he reached the summit. Or at least everyone thought he did, and his body was left on the mountain. And then, miraculously, his fellow climbers found him, still alive, the next morning. A story he tells in his book, Dead Lucky.
Well, what happened was we spent 20 minutes on the summit because I knew that the summit's halfway, and only 100 feet or so, 200 feet below the summit, I was stricken with cerebral edema. Now, cerebral edema is fluid retention within your skull. It puts pressure on your brain and basically kills you. And basically what happened to me was I passed out from a tremendous sense of lethargy. I just seemed to have no energy. I've actually rescued someone with cerebral edema from much lower height, but the way he responded to the edema was he just wanted to sit and mutter nonsense in the snow. And my friend and I tried to carry him like a drunk man you're trying to put into his car or into the gutter or wherever you want to put him. I mean, it's very hard to carry someone who doesn't want to be carried. So that was my experience of cerebral edema. But I actually don't remember this phase. But what I wanted to do was I actually wanted to go back up the mountain. Apparently there were three black women up there I wanted to visit. And I wanted to jump off the Kanchung face, which is, you know, it's 9,000-foot drop. I mean, 22 years, I'm not coming back. Here's my only chance. And that sounds crazy, and of course it is crazy. There was an Indian climber who a couple of weeks earlier had actually jumped off the Kanchung face, and who knows where that came from. So the Sherpas, luckily, that I was with, they were able to get a rope on me and pull me down like a bull that doesn't want to be castrated, and stop me jumping off the face. But the problem with that is that I sort of made sure I had enough juice in my system to get down to a lower camp so I'd be able to get off the mountain. But all this craziness, all this energy I wasted meant that I only got down, the summit's 29,035 feet, I only got down to 28,000 feet, and then I could move no more. And it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and Pemba was saying, Lincoln, you're going to have to spend the night here. And I wanted to tell him that, look, I've been in this situation before where I've exhausted and I can't move. So what I've done in the past is I go down, I have a rest, I go down 100 feet, 200 feet, have another rest, and then maybe 200, 300 feet the next time, have another rest. I was going to tell Pemba that's what I wanted to do. But unfortunately, I couldn't even speak, so I never gave that message to Pemba.
So you were actually aware. Now, what's the rule at this point? He has to think about himself and the other two Sherpas. If you're fighting, if you won't go, what does he do? Try to revive you, try to pull you, and then just say goodbye?
Well, actually, Pemba had come up. There were the three Sherpas I was with, and Pemba had come up because actually another one of our party had died, and so he no longer needed Pemba's services. So the expedition leader suggested that Pemba climb back up to where I was. So I had four Sherpas with me. But Pemba was totally exhausted from what he'd gone through, and I'd actually injured him accidentally by kicking him, and I didn't even realize I'd hurt him until afterwards. But anyway, and he was snowblind. So Dorji, one of the Sherpas, went down with Pemba. Two other Sherpas stayed with me, and they noticed, they were trying to, I was showing no signs of life, so they're desperately trying to find signs of life, but they couldn't find there was no pulse, there was no breathing. One of them poked me in the eye, there was no response, so.
So you were dead?
Well, yeah, yes. That's what they concluded, and the expedition leader, 2 hours after I was just lying there, ordered them to come down to save themselves.
Now, it's worth mentioning that they went down, reluctantly, I'm sure, and they, as they quite reasonably should, informed the world that you were not coming back.
That's right.
What do you remember of that time? Anything at all?
I remember really enjoying the sunset. And usually you don't get when you're on a mountain and you're not at your camp, you don't really enjoy the sunset when it's setting because you just got to get out of there. Yeah. But I wasn't really in the present or in the past. But then I started to have some hallucinations. I remember this sort of being like when you have suddenly you switch on your noise reduction headphones when you're in an aeroplane. Suddenly it's silent. And that's how it sort of felt when I died, I think. But then, of course, there was a blank time, but there was some spark in me somewhere that tweaked my brain to start working, and I started having hallucinations. So there was an incomplete picture, so the wrong files appeared. So I found myself in strange places. But each of the hallucinations had an element of hope and had an element of, well, there was a message to just stay put. Yeah. And actually what happened in the middle of the night, suddenly out of nowhere, I was totally lucid. And just as well, I hadn't moved in my hallucinations because I could feel this huge, really freezing, swirling wind, which meant there was a huge precipice nearby, when in fact there were two huge precipices. But yeah, and that's then I realised I had frostbitten fingers, that, you know, hypothermia, hypoxia. I wasn't aware about the cerebral edema, but that had certainly drained me. Yeah. And I just realised that I was going to die.
That's a funny question to ask. Did it bother you?
Well, it didn't initially because, well, that sounds a bit strange.
No, I don't think it does. I think that you were in such a state that life or death was not the primary concern, actually.
Yeah, there was an incredible welcoming sense in just going into a hypoxic or hypothermic sort of state of just relaxing and then just drifting off and never drifting back again. But, I won't say unfortunately because all is well that ends well, but then I remembered my family, and that was the driver that made me think, no, well, I'm not going to die now. I can't die. I've got to come home. I've turned back so many times. I'm not going to have made that a waste of time and go and die now. No, my thoughts weren't quite that logical, but the whole thing was that I had to get down. Now, it seemed like a totally hopeless situation, and, it was a place without hope, so...
Yeah, you had no reason to believe that they were going to come back up and find you. I mean, you should have been dead when they finally did get there.
Yes, that's right.
What time was it the next day when they found you? Do you remember them coming to you?
Well, it was first light of dawn, yes. Initially, I remember being alone. Hallucination sort of led me to the top, not to the top, but back to that spot where I actually really was. And I think it was their arrival that brought me into that point, as well as the hallucination ending. The hallucination was interrupted by the reality of their arrival. And there were four of them. There was Dan Mazur, Andrew Brash, Miles Osborne, and Jangbu Sherpa on their way to the summit. Another perfect day, maybe 3 hours of climbing till they got there. And then they find me. They'd been told to expect my body, and instead they found me sitting there talking to them.
It's extraordinary. And I keep thinking about your family having been told you were dead at this point, and it's, 12 hours later?
Yes, that's right. They were actually told the previous night, and it was actually 20 hours later that it was confirmed that I was alive, because the reports coming out of base camp from basically cowboys with sat phones and laptops had been inaccurate in all sorts of ways. So you couldn't trust what the news was. And so my friends back in Australia tried to protect my family from false hope. Actually, it turned out not to be false hope. So yes, it was a terrible 20 hours.
We haven't even talked about your coming down. You didn't want to make it the day before. Here you were hours and hours later in even lower energy levels, and somehow you got down. Frostbitten fingers, frostbitten toes?
Well, the process of getting down was quite a simple one, really. Dan Mazur and his team immediately got into action. The book's called Dead Lucky for good reason because, all sorts of things really, but one of them was, for instance, that Dan was testing in a sort of miniaturized way a new oxygen system, test driving it, and he had his regular one. So, no one carries a spare oxygen set. So, you might have a spare tank, but you don't have spare everything else's. So, that was lucky. So I had oxygen to breathe. They gave me something to drink, which made a huge difference. And then the sun came up, and that made a huge difference as well. They tied me onto the rope that was there so I wasn't going to slip off. So then the radio conversations back down to our advanced base camp, and the expedition leader sent up some Sherpas who were already on the mountain, dismantling camps, actually. It was right at the end of the season. And those two Sherpas brought oxygen up to me, and with that I was then able to come down. However, Dan, Miles, Andrew and Jangbu no longer had enough oxygen to get to the summit and back safely, so they basically sacrificed their chance of getting to the summit to save my life. And there wasn't even any discussion about it. That was just what they did. That was an extraordinary thing.
Yeah. So was it worth it, all of this?
Was it worth it? Well, I don't think... So I'm just laughing about certainly the guys who didn't get to the summit didn't think it was worth it. Well, actually, that's not true.
I think they probably did.
Yes, they did, actually.
They were part of something extraordinary.
Yeah, they were. And in fact, Andrew Brash, who's become a very good friend, he just summited Everest last week, actually, which was fantastic. I mean, he he said exactly that. When I saw him in Calgary last year, I stayed at his house, and he was saying that he thought it was rather cool to be part of this amazing rescue story.
So are you fully recovered? The frostbite wasn't...
Well, the frostbite certainly is. Or isn't, depends how you look at it, meaning that I've got the top joint of all my fingers missing, and my little fingers really are little fingers. Yeah, and I lost a whole toe.
But still, you saw the top of the world, you died and you came back. That's extraordinary.
Yes. In terms of that earlier question of yours, was it worth it? Reaching the summit wasn't worth what I went through, but I guess the insights into the nature of life and death, which is something we haven't even touched upon, were extraordinary for me, and that alone was worth it. And, of course, one thing that I would never, ever want to happen again is what my family went through.
We haven't talked at all about that. Do you feel as though you have a better understanding of life and death as a result of this?
Well, I do. I'm actually a Buddhist. And I guess what happened, one of the hallucinations was, well, it was a combination of dying and a sort of hallucinatory experience. But I came so close to death. I was so near to death. But I could see that it wasn't the Grim Reaper. It was actually a welcoming presence. And I was in that really privileged position of being able to sort of see that, but to be able to sort of, you know, reject the invitation and say, look, I'll be back. Don't worry, I'll be back, but I'm just not ready yet. And that was an extraordinary privilege. So I guess that sort of experience gelled with the Buddhist concept of that life and death is a cycle rather than just an end without a new beginning. And I guess the other thing that was an amazing lesson to me was what I had perceived as a reality, what I'd perceived as impossible. The limits to both those things were way, way further back than where I had placed them. So the parameters for the world now, for me, are different, and anything's possible.
That's Lincoln Hall, author of Dead Lucky, Life After Death on Mount Everest. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Facing Death, number 517A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Anne Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.